From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. It's Tech Tuesday. Mention drones, and most people think of stealth aircraft flying surveillance missions in war zones. But here at home, there's growing interest in friendlier, personal-sized drones you can buy off the shelf and take out to fly around for fun and for great photos and videos if you attach a camera to your drone. The newest personal drones look like high-tech descendants of the old model airplanes and helicopters, measuring a couple of feet across and outfitted with sophisticated positioning and location technology like you find in your smartphone. Everyone from model plane enthusiasts to professional photographers to farmers is experimenting with these new flying machines that give them an eye in the sky. But the growing popularity of camera-equipped personal drones is raising a host of questions about privacy, safety, and the nuisance factor. The National Park Service, for instance, is working on rules to balance the desires of tech enthusiasts with the interests of the wildlife and natural landmarks it's supposed to protect. Tech Tuesday explores the expanding capabilities of personal drones and the challenges they present. Joining us in studio is Jonathan Jarvis, director of the National Park Service. John, to see you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation, Kojo. Great to be here.
And joining us from Argo Studios in New York City is Clive Thompson. He writes for Smithsonian Magazine. He's the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
And joining us by phone from Austin, Texas is Colin Gwynn, Vice President at 3D Robotics, which makes consumer drones. Colin, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Colin, I'll start with you. Your company makes what your website describes as aerial vehicles with the consumer in mind, including a helicopter-like drone described as stylish and powerful, running the newest autopilot electronics. Explain what consumer drones look like today and the technology that makes them possible.
Well, like you said earlier, I think with the reduction in cost of micro electromechanical systems, MEMS gyros and MEMS accelerometers being purchased by the millions from cell phone manufacturers have really brought the cost of those sensors down, which is one of the most expensive parts of, you know, building the autopilot, which are the brains that make these flying robots work. And so with the cost of those things coming down, we can really bring, you know, incredibly intelligent flying robots or drones to the consumer market for extremely attainable prices.
How far can go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask, how far can a personal drone fly and for how long before its battery needs to be recharged?
Sure. So, you know, most personal drones now, we're seeing flight times around 20 minutes. You know, we have drones that are a little bit more in the commercial space that can fly for over an hour, but your cost, you know, go up sharply when you get to those types of flight times. So, but for a commercial or a consumer drone, you're looking at, you know, 20 minutes of flight time, and it can fly along at about 25 miles an hour. So, you know, all of our drones are actually programmable from an Android tablet or a Macintosh computer or a PC computer. So you can actually prescribe the flight plan for the drone. So, you know, you could essentially have it fly several miles back and forth. But most of the people that are flying these small, you know, consumer drones are just kind of flying around within line of sight, you know, under 400 feet, because that's the current, you know, FAA, you know, suggested guidelines that they released with 9117.
Let me invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling 800-433-8850. How do you feel about photo drones flying overhead and filming or snapping pictures? 800-433-8850. What rules would you like to see for unmanned aerial vehicles in the hands of hobbyists? You can also send email to Kojo at WAMU.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show using the hashtag TechTuesday, or go to our website, KojoShow.org, and join the conversation there. Colin, how much do personal drones cost, and who's buying them?
Well, the second question is easy. Everybody. I mean, it's literally everyone from a farmer that has a vineyard potentially, or an action sports enthusiast, or maybe a real estate agent trying to get aerial photos and videos of a home, or, you know, just somebody that likes tech gadgets and wants to take some great aerial photos on their vacation in Hawaii. I mean, it literally really covers the spectrum. And the cost, you know, our consumer Iris drone, which has everything you need to fly, is only $750 US. So very reasonable cost.
How hard is it to learn to fly one?
It's actually extremely easy. Again, with the use of, you know, advanced accelerometers and barometric altimeters and magnetometers and all of these sensors, we actually make it very, very easy to fly. So all you're really doing is telling the drone where you want it to go. It uses satellite-guided navigation so that when you take off, it maintains its position in space based on satellite information. So even if there's a 10 or 15-mile-an-hour wind, when you take off, the drone is just going to sit there and wait for you to command it to go forward, back, left, right. So it only goes where you tell it to go. You don't have to actively try to fly it and fight the wind and do things like that. And then taking it even one step easier is that you can literally just use an Android phone, draw your finger on a map, and then say go, and the drone will literally take off, follow that exact plan, come back and land itself, all without you ever having to use the controller to manually fly it.
Colin,
so, it's very easy.
Colin Gwynn is vice president of 3D Robotics, which makes consumer drones. In case you're just joining us, it's a Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of personal and photo drones. He joins us from Austin, Texas. In our Washington studio is Jonathan Jarvis, director of the National Park Service. And joining us from studios in New York City is Clive Thompson, who's a writer for Smithsonian Magazine and author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive, Colin says they're all easy to fly, but from what I've been seeing and hearing, some people who are learning seem to crash them a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Partly because not all drones are created equal, of course. Some are harder to fly than others. The more expensive ones, the ones that we've been talking about here that have really good internal systems, you know, those are a little easier. But if you go on to YouTube, you'll see a lot of really funny outtakes of video of people, attempting to just shoot a football game or a wedding and sort of occasionally smashing into people. By and large, though, there's an experimental phase right now. A lot of people get one, they start fiddling around with it, they crash a bunch at the beginning, and then they figure it out. The question is, and I think this is something that's come up definitely when you look at things like national parks, is, what if the first time someone flies it and doesn't know what they're doing, it's in a public park and they crash it into a body of water? You know, you just dumped a toxic battery into a public resource.
Indeed. That's one of the reasons we have Jonathan Jarvis with us. He is the director of the National Park Service. John, national parks have some of the most beautiful scenery in the country, so they're an obvious destination for drone users who want to take photos or video. What are some of the misadventures that you've seen with drones in national parks like Yellowstone, Zion, and Mount Rushmore?
Well, we saw it early on, sort of a proliferation of these drones in the parks, and we decided to do a timeout. I issued a policy memorandum in June of this year directing the National Park Service to do sort of a stand down on their use so we could sort of understand this new technology and its effect on our responsibilities. The National Park Service has a responsibility to protect these incredible resources like the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone, also to provide for visitor safety and the high-quality experience. And we were seeing all of these affected. As you indicated, we had a drone recently crash into the Grand Prismatic Spring in Yellowstone. That water is hot. It's part of the thermal system of Yellowstone, 160 degrees and about 160 feet deep. We have not been able to recover what's left of that drone. We also had incidents with drones chasing a bighorn sheep at Zion National Park. We had it flying over a crowd and over the sculptures at Mount Rushmore. We had one flying back and forth in front of visitors trying to watch the sunset at Grand Canyon. So we've had a lot of these. So we are sort of doing a timeout for bad behavior, shall we say.
Indeed, you decided to tell all your park superintendents to ban drones until you can develop system-wide rules for their use.
That's correct.
And how long is that going to take?
It'll probably take about 18 months for us to really evaluate. There may very well may be places and times where they are appropriate, but that's going to take us some time to figure out.
What are the rules for operating drones in a national park right now?
As of the 20th of August, every park in the system has issued a prohibition. We have a few exceptions in places where more sort of model aircraft are used, like at Floyd Bennett Field and Gateway. You can get a permit for commercial photography, and there are some administrative uses, very tightly controlled, that will be allowed, but it's all under a permit system now.
James in Arlington, Virginia, has a question about exactly where drones are allowed to fly. James, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
How are you? My question is, being in the District of Columbia, what's stopping someone from necessarily standing on the banks of Arlington with, you know, their camera, being able to fly it with, you know, their smartphone or computer over the monuments in D.C., you know, whether it be flying up to the White House, which I guarantee you probably would be, you know, taken care of quickly. But what are the regulations that are in place or guidelines that are out there?
Clive Thompson, we're now talking about coming under the authority of the Federal Aviation Administration, right?
Yeah. I mean, this stuff is evolving right now. There's a lot of talk in different – you could go around to like almost every town or every state at the federal level, and you could see them trying to figure out what rules there are for drones. Now, as we talked about earlier, there are height restrictions that are already in place across the entire country, you know, that you can only fly them at certain height. But that's only one part of what people are wrestling with. The other things they're wrestling with are should there be any, you know, privacy restrictions? You know, is there any weird issues about like someone hovering a drone outside someone's window and peering inside? And, you know, the truth is some of this case law is sort of really up in the air because, if you looked at what precedents exist, well, you know, generally the law of the land with photography is that, you know, if you're out in public, you know, you don't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if someone takes a picture of you, you know, they can do that. If you are in a private place where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, then someone is not allowed to take a picture of you without your permission. So the question becomes, you know, if a drone is flying outside your window, is that a reasonable expectation of privacy? And this is kind of up in the air.
I guess they're going to have to draft rules about whether or not you can bring them down also if you happen to see it outside your bathroom window.
Yeah, there was a municipality that considered a law to allow people to shoot down drones.
I was thinking of bringing them down with nets or anything else.
Yeah. You could imagine all sorts of countermeasures. I mean, the truth is, it'd probably take a long time for the stuff to get settled by the courts. Like, you know, as an example, the FBI, you know, they've done things like they've flown over drug places where they think people are growing marijuana, right? And so they fly a plane over. And in the past, there was a case where someone had a panel missing from their roof, and the FBI looked inside and saw they were growing marijuana inside. And so the actual marijuana growers sort of countersued and said, that's an invasion of privacy. You're peering into our house. And the judge essentially sort of said, well, the thing is, if the panel was missing from your roof, someone flying even in a regular plane landing could have seen inside, so there was no incursion of privacy. So as you can see, they're very deep waters here that will take a long time to be settled, I think, case law-wise.
Well, Congress has directed the FAA to develop rules for commercial drones by September of next year. In the meantime, Clive, do the FAA's rule for model aircraft apply to this new breed of personal drones? And how do you think the rulemaking will play out?
I'm not a lawyer. So my specialty is not really in the law. But that's as I understand it, yes. How I think it's going to play out, you know, there's a lot of tensions here. On the one hand, people are understandably concerned about the way that this affects privacy. On the other hand, there's a lot of very legitimate and good uses of drones, right? I mean, environmentalists are already very excited by the fact that they can use it to understand what's going on in the community around them in a way that they couldn't before. That's happening around the world. Although we heard about people chasing wildlife with them, they're also a great way to, in a very non-invasive way, monitor what's going on with wildlife. So there's a lot of fantastic uses. Just aesthetically, they're kind of opening up new vistas for everyday photography, too. I mean, there's something delightful about that. It's like the way the Polaroid changed the way we take pictures with instant snapshots, or you go back 100 years, the way the Kodak camera changed photography. It suddenly gave people new ways to look at the world. And so those desires for people to do that stuff are legitimate and interesting and aesthetically and culturally quite fun. So they will have to be balanced out with people's reasonable privacy expectations.
Colin Gwynn, how do you think this rulemaking will play out?
Well, I think that's a great question, and one that it would take probably a crystal ball to figure out. It seems to be all over the place in the last 6 or 7 years that I've been involved with this. So, trying to figure out, exactly the methodology that it's going to take. It really does seem like it's all over the place. So, we have been very open and vocal with the FAA to say, look, we'd love to work with you guys to figure out the best, methodology for integrating these flying robots into our national airspace in a safe and responsible manner. And so we've actually just created the small UAS coalition run by Aiken Kump in Washington, D.C., and we're partnered with Amazon and Parrot and DJI and GoPro and a couple of other companies so that we can kind of band together and say, hey, what can we do to work with you guys to find a reasonable solution? But, I wish I could answer that question accurately. I wish I had that crystal ball, but I guess we're just going to have to wait and see and try to be as proactive as we can. But at the same time, we're a little bit at the mercy of the FAA and the lawmaking bodies.
And I guess, Jonathan Jarvis, you'll be looking at that process also fairly closely to see how the FAA rulemaking goes, because I guess you can use it to judge or to assess your own rulemaking efforts.
Absolutely. And we work very closely with the FAA on overflights of the national parks. And so, but within the parks themselves right now, we think we need to take this little time out to assess and figure out how to use them in the future.
Colin Gwynn, we got a tweet from Rich who said, we need to differentiate between a drone and a radio-controlled hobby aircraft. How important is that distinction?
Well, I think what he's saying, and I would agree with, is that there's a big difference between a 25 or a 54-pound drone that's carrying heavier payloads or maybe cinematography equipment or maybe monitoring payloads versus a 2-pound or less hobby drone that you just want to get some nice aerial photos with, that really, would be very hard pressed to cause any kind of damage. And so, if that's what he's saying, I think that makes very perfect sense, because right now, according to the FAA, you have SUAS, which is small unmanned aerial system. The ironic thing is that SUAS means anything less than 55 pounds, and obviously, there's a big difference between a 50-pound single-rotor helicopter and a 2-pound quad rotor carrying a GoPro.
Well, Rich,
I absolutely agree that there should be a distinction between the two.
Rich brings me to this before you leave. Can you talk about the innovations we can expect in consumer drones? What will we see next?
Well, I think what everybody's working on and waiting for is, I think in terms of future innovation, it's going to be a matter of making these systems easier and easier to fly and control, so you don't have those new pilots that are accidentally crashing into things. And then another big innovation that everybody's working on and waiting, with bated breath is object avoidance and object awareness. So, it'd be great if you're flying along and maybe the pilot gets confused in his orientation or her orientation and starts heading toward a tree or something like that, and the drone just stops itself because it can see the tree there and it can avoid that object. So, I think object awareness and object avoidance, and then also just advancements in the autopilot technology to make it easier and easier for the drone to go where you're wanting it to go.
And of course there's size there. Looking forward to having a drone in someone's pocket, right?
Yeah, that is going to be a tough one, because you have this thing called physics, which you have to fight wind, and you need a certain amount of mass to fight that wind. So having little pocket drones that can actually be, usable is going to that's going to be a challenging one. I'd like to see a pocket drone that
look for that huge waves, the return of huge cargo pockets. We got an email from
that's right, exactly.
We got an email from Gene in Annapolis who says it was just announced that Disney has applied for patents for utilizing drone technology for entertainment in its parks. One possible use is drones projecting images onto a screen held up by drones. A whole new world. An email from Karen pleads, please, no, humans are fallible, and soon they'll be accidentally causing something to crash and maybe causing someone to die. On the other hand, this email from Irene says, all I have to say is I'm getting one. I can be at the house and send it out to spy on my horses in their pasture and check up on my kids. We're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, we'll be continuing this conversation on the future of personal and photo drones. Colin Gwynn, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Colin Gwynn is Vice President of 3D Robotics, which makes consumer drones. You can still call us, 800-433-8850. Have you ever flown a drone just for fun or to take photos or movies? Give us a call, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi.
And good afternoon. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. I'm your host, Pat Brogan. Mostly sunny, 85 degrees now. WAMU 88.5 in Strathmore are giving away tickets to see Nitty Gritty Dirt Band with opening act Sierra Hall. It's Saturday, August 30th at 8 in the evening. More information is at WAMU.org. Just look under events.
WAMU 88.5 is looking for a full-time web developer with a passion for public radio.
Clean code.
Innovative technology.
Smart design.
PHP.
JavaScript.
Share our passion for interactive storytelling. Join the web team. Apply today at wamu.org/jobs.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Morocco, welcoming visitors to experience its culture and history in Marrakesh, Tangier, Fez, Casablanca, Rabat, and more. Details at moroccoonthemove.com. From Pepco's EnergyWise Rewards Program, an automatic way to help Maryland customers save energy. Details at 1-877-ENERGY or energywisereward.pepco.com. And from General Dynamics Information Technology, dedicated to providing IT solutions that meet the challenges of a new era in healthcare. General Dynamics IT, gdit.com/health.
Welcome back to our Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of personal and photo drones. We're talking with Jonathan Jarvis. He is the director of the National Park Service. Clive Thompson is a writer for Smithsonian Magazine, the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. He joins us from Argo Studios in New York City. You can call us at 800-433-8850. What do you think is the proper balance between fun new technology like consumer drones carrying cameras and the public's right to privacy and quiet? 800-433-8850. You can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet at Kojo Show. Joining us in studio now is Christopher Vo, president of the D.C. Area Drone User Group. Christopher Vo is a Ph.D. candidate in robotics at George Mason University. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's look at some of the reasons people buy off-the-shelf drones and even build their own. How many members do you have here in D.C., in the D.C. Area Drone User Group, and how many are using their drones for some sort of photography?
Well, the D.C. Area Drone User Group consists of about 1,200 drone operators in the D.C. area, and they're all interested in the responsible use of drones.
1,200?
That's right.
When was the organization started?
About 2 years ago.
And you've up to 1,200. Despite the safety and nuisance concerns about drones, everyone seems to agree that they have great potential, not only for fun, but to help survey and photograph hard-to-reach places. Park Service employees can still apply to use them for research projects. John, where can drones be useful for your team?
Well, we think, as has been indicated, that particularly in monitoring wildlife, monitoring natural resources, even looking at damage from hurricanes or other things, I think drones have a great potential for
getting to places that we might endanger an individual to get to or to look at something remotely. So we're evaluating them now for their utilization for research, monitoring, projects like that.
Christopher Vo, how many of your 1,200 members are using drones for photography and in what ways?
I think that about most of our users are using drones for photography as opposed to other uses. It's probably the most popular application, especially photography for videography and making movies.
Some drones can fly a pre-programmed route, as Colin was telling us earlier, or follow you as you ride your bike. Clive, what software and hardware upgrades are on the horizon?
Well, I think the there's going to be a lot of stuff that's based on where you are related to the drone and the drone's awareness of the world around you. So one that just sort of came out of the gates a few months ago is a pretty cool one that you can sort of program to hover a certain distance away from you. So if you want to, you know, go for a run, if you wanted to go on a mountain biking thing, if you wanted to do something kind of interesting and have it sort of follow you as if there were like this very expensive Hollywood shot, you know, of what you look like in the sky, you know, you can do that. And so that's something you're going to see. The other thing you're going to see, I've seen a lot of people working on this is, we got a taste this earlier when we were talking to the 3D robotics gentleman, is drones that can know a little bit more about the world around them and make decisions based on where they are. So, and that could be helping them not crash, but that could also be like, you know, if you see something interesting or try and follow this thing, so you could get several drones sort of flying in a configuration, you know, together, which can be kind of fun to look at, but could also itself produce some really interesting photography. You could get you get 3D photography, you know, from a bunch of different angles. There's a lot of interesting things going on around giving the drones a bit of intelligence to help them make decisions for themselves. A
couple of questions for you, Christopher. How do you personally use personal drones, mainly for photography?
Well, no, I'm actually a researcher in robotics at George Mason University, and so what I try to do is make algorithms for robots, many robots, to move safely through an environment, not just aerial robots, but also other kinds of robots as well.
What's the technical, what do you see as the next technical advancement that we'll be seeing in personal drones, like I was asking Colin Gwynn about earlier? Will they get quieter? Do you think they'll get smaller?
There's already a lot of startup projects that are changing the way that we interact with drones. For example, instead of manually operating them with, say, joysticks, one day you might have a drone the size of a butterfly fly out of your pocket with voice commands. You tell it, for example, to follow you while you're going down the ski slopes. Or you can bring a drone to the park with a tennis ball and play catch with it, or put a leash on it and take it for a walk.
Clive, what's the likelihood that drones will be able to carry things around for us, or that Amazon will be able to deliver packages using drones, as its chief Jeff Bezos has predicted? Why do you laugh?
Well, I laugh because I think the idea is so funny of all these funny, entertaining slash, you know, terrifying, crazy of all these drones flying through the sky delivering packages. The truth is, drones like that would face one big problem, which is that if you want to carry anything of any weight at all, you need a lot of power. And that means you need a very, very big battery. But now that you've got a heavy battery, you need more power. So you need more batteries so you can see how this sort of scales downwards. The truth is, getting drones to carry anything very heavy is far off in the future, to the point where we have a much more energy-dense source of power than current lithium-ion batteries. I'm not saying that's not going to happen, but people have been working pretty hard at thinking of a new battery chemistry for, you know, 20 years now, because they're trying to make it for electric cars, and they haven't really hit upon anything very good yet. So until there is some way to store way more power at a much lighter weight, something the military would love and something that the electric car industry would love, drones are not going to be carrying very heavy packages. You're not going to be getting your groceries via drone anytime soon.
Well, some people believe there should be a distinct separation made between drones as a function of the military and just about everything else. Here's Andrew in Baltimore, Maryland. Andrew, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Kojo.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
I just wanted to talk briefly about how the term drone, I think in today's zeitgeist, it... it sensationalizes what's essentially a hobby. You know, people hear the term drone and they think bombing drones in the Middle East. That's really all I wanted to talk about. It's not a militaristic thing right now. These are essentially helicopters with multi-rotors. You know, you have 3, 4, sometimes 8. They're not these 40-foot wingspan automated missile dropping contraptions.
Chris Foe, have you encountered this during the course of your research talking about drones? That just the name drones causes people to think, oh, this is military equipment.
Yeah, a drone really is just an unmanned aircraft. And to compare the kind of drones that I use for my research or the kind of drones that the users in the D.C. area drone user group build to military machines is like comparing bicycles to tanks.
You're feeling Clive Thompson?
I think that's an interesting comment about how drones have this kind of multivalent meaning right now, because it is true. I mean, depending on who you talk to, the word drone, you know, is really a politically freighted term. It's a representation of the way America has been perceived abroad and perceived domestically with its use of power. Or if you talk to someone who's really just thinking like, you know, this is a fun hobby, you get a completely different thing. You know, I suppose if the industry that makes the little sort of, you know, hobby drones were thinking carefully, it would probably try and come up with a different name for them, because I agree there's sort of a kind of a negative connotation I feel whenever I hear the word drone. It doesn't sound like a positive term.
Jonathan Jarvis, from your standpoint, how is a photo drone flying over a hiking trail in Yosemite different from a sightseeing plane flying over the Grand Canyon in terms of disrupting wildlife and, well, annoying park visitors?
Well, I think the challenge is that whether one person's experience through using an unmanned aerial vehicle, if you want to call it that, versus a drone, may impact others' experience. You know, if an aircraft is up and we have advisories over our national parks for airplane and helicopters, and these would be flying, obviously, much, much closer to the ground. And our experience thus far is these are fairly noisy, at least the current technology. They can be somewhat analogous to a flying weed eater, and it's going right over your head, and you're trying to have a park-like experience can be very disturbing. So that's one of our concerns.
On to the telephones again. Here is Keith in Alexandria, Virginia. Keith, your turn.
Yes. My comment is that I think there should be strict liability on the part of the owners or operators of the drones themselves. You know, if a drone falls out of the sky and damages my car, you know, I think they should be liable, and wondered if there's insurance to cover such claims. I'll take my answer off the air.
Clive Thompson, what do you know about the insurance aspects of this issue?
I don't know anything about that, and that would be. But I think I'm willing to bet there are insurance people out there pondering this right now. I mean, for example, you look at the policy for my house. It does not cover acts of God like asteroid strikes, actually mentioned by phrase in the ponderously long policy, which I read sort of for amusement. So it would not shock me if I open that policy a year from now and it includes a drone slamming into my house. They might well consider that to be similar to an act of God, like a meteor.
Email from Dave in Reston, probably having to do with the insurance issue also. Even a 2-pound drone would hurt if it fell 100 feet out of the sky and landed on you. What rules do we need for control of drones? What about autonomous drones without a ground control link? Until we resolve the rules of the sky, I'm not in favor of drones except in well-defined airspaces. We move on now to Laurie in Annapolis, Maryland. Laurie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My comment is really, I think drones are, you know, it's the user common sense, obviously. They need some rules and regulations. There are going to be people who abuse or even the rules and regulations. But my main comment is that the privacy thing, Google Earth can give you detail. I can look at my sister's house 600 miles from my own home, and I can see in detail what's her backyard, what's in it, everything in very close detail. So what's the difference, you know, if you're driving a drone around taking photographs? It's no different than Google Earth.
Is it, Clive Thompson?
You know, I think the difference is that the Google satellite images are still pictures. They don't show what's actually happening right now. A drone is that has a camera in it hovering over your backyard is showing some of what you're doing at that instant in much closer granularity. Now, the comment is correct in one sense. It really throws to this question of what constitutes a reasonable right to privacy right now, right? And, you know, since we don't have any legal objection in the U.S., although you go to places like Germany and it's different, we don't have any legal objection to, you know, a satellite picture on Google Earth or Google Maps of our house. That doesn't seem, or it certainly hasn't been presented to the courts as a as an incursion of anyone's privacy. That seems like a reasonably public thing. You know, a drone flying, you know, not on your property, but near enough to your property, they can see what you're doing in your backyard or front yard. You know, that's a slightly different legal question, and I think it will be interesting to see that come forward. I definitely expect to see lawsuits like that in the future.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, you're welcome to join us in this Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of personal and photo drones. You can do that by calling 800-433-8850. If you had a personal drone, what would you use it for? You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show using the hashtag Tech Tuesday. Or go to our website, kojoshow.org, ask a question or make a comment there. I'm Kojo Namdi.
And good afternoon. This is WAMU 88.5. I'm your host, Pat Brogan. 12:43 now. Partly cloudy skies, 85 degrees. In southeast Washington, sunny skies today. High is 85. Mostly clear tonight with a low of 62 expected tonight.
Coming up at 1, the case for free money. Why some libertarians and others advocate the radical idea of giving everyone a basic income. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
The Emmy Awards have inspired us to feature some of our interviews with great actors in TV series. On the next Fresh Air...
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No, I am the one who knocks.
We feature our interview with Bryan Cranston, who starred in Breaking Bad. Join us.
Fresh Air starts at 2 o'clock today.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Capital College, offering master's and doctoral degrees through practical education in engineering, information sciences, cybersecurity, and business. More info at capital-college.edu. And from General Dynamics Information Technology, increasing operational readiness with simulation and training products, services, and solutions. General Dynamics IT, gdit.com/training-and-simulation.
Welcome back to our conversation on Tech Tuesday on the future of personal and photo drones. We're talking with Christopher Vo. He is president of the D.C. Area Drone User Group. Chris is a Ph.D. candidate in robotics at George Mason University. He joins us in studio along with Jonathan Jarvis, the director of the National Park Service. Joining us from studios in New York City is Clive Thompson. He's a writer for Smithsonian Magazine and author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Chris, what are some of the possible scenarios for regulating personal drone use? Would it make sense to require people to get a license to operate a private drone?
Well, at the very least, the FAA should promulgate regulations that define clear and reasonable limits for model aircraft based on some kind of straightforward parameters, like maybe altitude, weight, and speed. For example, they should focus on rules that protect the navigable airspace, just like they would with kites, balloons, and model rockets. They should maybe have some exemptions that for the responsible use of small and lightweight aircraft that are maybe flying at low altitudes, and otherwise in accordance to local laws.
We got an email from Mike in Baltimore, John Jarvis, who writes, it's important to keep in mind that a photographer using a drone or taking a picture on or from public space is not the enemy. Photography has a long history of documenting the American experience from beach life to city life to rural life. A photographer is almost always just doing his or her job and enjoying a hobby.
Well, I would agree with that. The national parks are venues for extraordinary photography. And we love that. We love to have both our private and commercial photographers come to our national parks. I think the challenge for me, though, is, you know, if you go to the Lamar Valley of Yellowstone National Park and you want to stand along the roadside with your camera and your big lens and take photographs of a pack of wolves, that's one thing. But if you're flying a drone out over the valley and disturbing those wolves, and disturbing the other photographer's ability to photograph this natural world, that's a problem for us.
Because it seems to me that in one of the cases that you mentioned earlier, among the wildlife, the mothers were separated from the children, and that can lead to a serious problem.
That's correct. That was at Zion National Park, where we did have a drone basically separating a bighorn sheep family. In an attempt to get a good photograph.
On to the phones again. Here is Paul in Leesburg, Virginia. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. My question is about the difference between a drone with autonomy and a remotely piloted vehicle. I mean, the retail drones, the retail quad rotors and such, seem to always have a person at the controls. They don't have intelligence. They generally can't come back to you. If they lose comms, you lose the drone. Whereas the things you read about in the papers seem to have some level of smartness. If there's not a pilot, they can pilot themselves to some degree. Is there really a distinction in what we're talking about here?
Is there, Christopher?
Well, I mean, drones today are mostly remotely piloted. Most people are just using their joysticks to control them. And maybe tomorrow we'll have a lot more of these autonomous drones, and then we'll have to think about some of the issues related to, well, what happens when an autonomous drone makes its own decision to crash itself into something or harm somebody.
Care to comment on that, Clive Thompson?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that is happening up and down, certainly in the military, where they have been, hiring, philosophers and legal thinkers to think about what are the legal and ethical and moral implications of, say, autonomous robots that hurt someone, that kill someone, because they've definitely, been developing that type of robotics, for quite some time. And, there's no clear consensus yet at that level as to who in the chain of command, bears moral and ethical authority for that type of stuff. I think definitely, you're going to see it's a little easier to determine who's responsible for something as simple as a collision in a national park. If someone put the drone up in the air, they're the ones that stood for it. So it'll be a little easier to establish culpability. But I do think that it's interesting we're talking about national parks here, because I think that you could almost divide where it's going to be easy to sort of, or easier to figure out the rules of drones and where it's going to be harder. Now, the easier stuff is going to be situations where the government and the civic sphere already has a well-defined sense that there's a special place we're protecting. National Park's a good example of that. I mean, I think a lot of people would probably be in favor of strong limitations on drone activity there. You could even say, I mean, I live here in New York City. I could see the same thing with, say, Central Park, The city could go, well, wait a minute. We don't want drones flying around necessarily in that area. It gets a little more complicated when you get to someone's private property, something you're doing on a private property, something they're doing on a small scale. It's going to require some pretty nuanced thinking, because we've mentioned several times here, there are some very positive aspects to drones. I mean, you think about photography in national parks. Well, the photography that emerged in the late 19th century with expert photographers, and then with amateurs in the 90s, as you got like the Kodak Brownie, it gave the public a way to look at these absolutely majestic spaces and see them and understand them. And that created the public consciousness that made us want to protect these national parks in the first place. You know, National Geographic revolutionized the way that we understand the natural world by having these lovely, beautiful photographs. It made it special, and it actually helped us, you know, feel a sense we need to protect these things. So photography has a role, and I suspect drone photography has a role, even in those types of spaces, but it's going to need to be very carefully determined.
On to Thomas in Springfield, Virginia. Thomas, your turn.
Yes, I have question is, how do you identify these guys? I mean, they're up there in the air, they're flying around, it's not like they have a number or a license or anything, and they do something naughty or illegal, they are totally anonymous, and it might be cheaper for the individual who has it to abandon it rather than bring it back, try the extraordinary measures to bring it back to base.
Well, there are two aspects to that. One in which you talked about earlier, Jonathan Jarvis, in which it goes into 150 deep of water, that's about 160 degrees temperature, and then the people who put it there just go away, and so you have no idea of what to do next.
We did get their license.
license plate number.
We did track them down over time when they turned in their rental vehicle. But you're correct. I mean, I think as Christopher indicated, right now the technology is usually there's somebody with a joystick somewhere nearby that we can find. But I think as these things become more autonomous, that's going to be a bigger challenge.
Chris, Clive, I'd like to hear your opinion about the email we got from Mark, who said, I think there should be a law that requires every UAV to have an identification label. If one crashes and does real damage, the user may just run away rather than own up to having done the damage. What do you say, Chris?
Well, it's really important to have users be accountable for their actions. We think that, you know, people who use drones in bad or unsafe ways should be accountable through, appropriate civil and criminal penalties. It's different from saying that I think we should ban all drones or anything like that. I certainly love the technology, and I want to see this technology being used in all types of things. But I think that the way to really approach this is to make sure that we have free and open access to the technology, but have perhaps things like licensing or perhaps a way to register drones so that we can identify those people and give them the appropriate penalties.
What do you say, Clive Thompson?
Well, it probably depends on the size of the drone. I mean, a comparable point might be, say, you know, cars versus bicycles. You know, you have to register your car, so we know who did something, because we recognize as a society that you can do a lot of damage with a car. We don't do that with bicycles. You don't need to license them. You know, so you can get hit by someone on a bicycle, they ride away, you never see them again. You know, there's no way to identify them unless you sort of see them. And that's because society's decided that the relative value of allowing bicycles to not be registered is a function of the value they provide and the more limited damage they can do. And when they do real damage, you know, someone sees someone and hunts them down. So it probably there's some sort of a line to be drawn between the very tiny drone that can't do much harm, can't fly for very long, can be found, versus the big one that can really do some damage.
It's Bernie in Rockville, Maryland. Bernie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say, last night I was watching watching cable, and Formula One racing somewhere in Europe was using drones very effectively. 14, 18, 20-second shots, full 360-degree turns. They were magnificent, and the quality is superb. They've been using drones for photography way back in the old, I wouldn't say rule, but older James Bond movies. Most of these things are done with someone who's piloting the drone and another fellow who's doing the photography. It's a two-man operation, especially when you get into the semi or fully professional stuff. And most of these guys don't play around just like in your local ball field. They go to model airplane parks that are, I know out in Poolsville, there's a lovely one to fly airplanes and fly helicopters that you have to be even qualified to do with. There's an organization called the AMA, American Model Association, that is very big on this stuff.
As a matter of fact, I was reading someplace, Jonathan Jarvis, that there is a national park that collaborates with a model airplane group. Where is that?
At Gateway, National Recreation Area in New York City. The old Floyd Bennett Field, we work with the model aircraft group.
That's what I'd read. And what do you think about Bernie's view, Clive Thompson, about the beauty? Well, you've already talked about the kind of photography that can be done. Bernie's call, I guess, just underscores that. Clive?
I can see all sorts of really fun things happening. I'm in a band, and you know, I've already thought, you know, I should find someone who has a drone that can do, you know, video shots in my neighborhood, because it'd be fun to have us go out in Prospect Park and play some songs while they fly around and get some great shots of us, because it would just be kind of fun to have that type of YouTube video. You know, for my band. So you know, I think anytime someone gets exposure to maybe not looking at a drone, but seeing it and thinking, oh, what could I do with this? You definitely see some creative possibilities open up.
Prospect Park is going to be busy this weekend. This is the weekend of the annual Labor Day Carnival in New York. There'll be millions of people around there.
Gerald, maybe not the time to do it.
Right. Gerald in Warrenton, Virginia. Gerald, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Kojo, thank you, and I like your show. The earlier caller talked about seeing a lot of detail on Google Earth. You know, those big satellites probably have a resolution of about 12 inches or something like that, and that's probably regulated by the National Reconnaissance Organization. But the resolution of any photographic device is determined by the aperture. There's a formula which spits out the resolution in arc seconds.
Sure.
If you can get real close with a small camera, you can get very finely detailed pictures. And you that would be compared with a very big platform at a much higher elevation. So, you know, determining these regulations by weight of an aircraft is not quite
and guess what?
The way to go about it.
You get the last comment, because we're just about out of time. Jonathan Jarvis is director of the National Park Service. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Chris Voas, president of the D.C. Area Drone User Group. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Clive Thompson is a writer for Smithsonian Magazine and the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, from pulled pork to beef brisket, a look at regional barbecue styles and why D.C. has adopted them all. Then at 1, bestseller versus critical darling, why a highly praised literary title doesn't always catch on with readers, but a fun read can sell millions. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
The Emmy Awards have inspired us to feature some of our interviews with great actors in TV series. On the next Fresh Air...
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Nandi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.